This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
GM would like you to never, ever call it Government Motors again. From APM, it's the Marketplace Midday Update podcast. I'm Jeff Horwich. This is December 19th. The U.S. and GM are getting ready to part ways. I'll also talk to Ralph Reed, he of the Christian Coalition and more lately the Faith and Freedom Coalition, about what social conservatives want out of budget talks. And we'll talk about the most precise, nastiest tasting gingerbread house you have ever had the pleasure to not eat.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The U.S. government is beginning to extract itself from General Motors. GM is spending more than $5 billion to buy back 200 million shares of its own stock from Uncle Sam. That leaves taxpayers still invested, but things are moving in the right direction, at least as far as GM is concerned. Mike Colias covers GM for Automotive News. Hi, Mike.
Good to be here.
To what extent does this get the government out of the U.S. auto business?
Well, it's a big step for GM to shed the whole Government Motors stigma. They bought back about 40% of the shares that the Treasury owns. So the Treasury will still have about 300 million shares left. But the other piece of big news is that the government has come out and said that within the next 12 to 15 months, they'll divest that too in the open market. So that will get the government completely out of GM.
So how does it look like taxpayers will do when all said and done on our investment bailing GM out?
Well, if you go back to the 2009 bailout, all in, the government spent about $49.6 billion. Most of that was in an equity stake. Some of it was a little bit of it was a loan that GM repaid. So if you look at everything GM has repaid and everything the Treasury has gotten back, the biggest chunk of which came in the 2010 IPO, the taxpayers are still out about $21 billion. That's the stake that the government still owns in GM. They'll still get something for that, but they won't get all of it.
GM has been anxious for this process to get underway. They've made no secret of that. Do you think GM has pretty much shed the Government Motors nickname and reputation that it seemed to be so concerned about?
Well, I think that it's not entirely, but I think it's come a long way, even before today's announcement. I think that that started to fade from people's minds, but it's certainly front and center you know, for them. And they've came out today and said they think that it has hurt their ability to sell cars, in addition to weighing on the stock price, but just the average consumer. They feel like it just a big chunk of their customer base, you know, government ownership is a term that leaves a bad taste in their mouth. So they think that by this step, and as the Treasury continues to unload shares, that they think they'll sell more cars because they're getting past that.
Mike Colias reports on GM for Automotive News. Thanks, Mike.
You bet.
And let's do the numbers. After 2 days of strong market gains on Wall Street, so far this morning looks like there's not much fiscal cliff enthusiasm to go around. The Dow and the S&P are both down a bit a few hours into trading. The NASDAQ is flat. Shares of GM, though, are up more than 8% on news of that share buyback. We got news this morning of the big settlement that everybody pretty much knew was coming. The Swiss bank UBS will pay $1.5 billion to settle accusations that it rigged that key global interest rate. I think you know what's coming here, LIBOR. Quick update on something we talked about yesterday. We talked about the erupting anger at Instagram after the Facebook-owned photo-sharing service changed its terms of service for users. The new terms seem to let Instagram reserve the right to sell the photos that you post without giving you a cut. So, late last night, Instagram's co-founder said everyone had misunderstood the new terms. Instagram would not do such a thing, but the service is updating the controversial language anyway, just to eliminate the confusion. The users have spoken, and Instagram now seems to have one fewer way to make money. After a rush of home building in October, November turned out to be a little bit muted. Much of that you can blame on Sandy. The storm definitely seems to have slowed down construction in the Northeast. But for the big picture on housing starts and some other data we're looking at today, let's bring in John Sylvia, chief economist at Wells Fargo. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
When you look at this monthly housing starts report today, what's the data that matters to you?
Well, I think you picked out one element that was kind of key. They break out housing starts by basically four different regions, and the region that went down was the Northeast. The Midwest and the South continue to improve. They certainly were not impacted by Hurricane Sandy. I think the other point that's important to recognize is that over the last 3 months, both single-family and multifamily housing starts have risen compared to the 3 months before. So the housing market does appear to have good forward momentum. Overall, in terms of the longer run trends, still very strong multifamily housing starts as a share of the total housing starts, again, reflecting a lot of young people building up perhaps savings for a down payment on a house, but also still uncertain about their economic future and their jobs.
Some more apartments to go around. Let's shift to corporate news here before we wrap up.
Sure.
FedEx reported earnings today, and profits there took a step backward in November. Notably, though, FedEx did not lower its outlook going forward, which is something we've seen a lot of companies do lately. So what's FedEx tell us about the broader economy?
Well, in the short run, it tells us there's a weaker global economy, but also the higher price of gasoline, I think, or airplane fuel really impacted their results. But longer term, they really continue to benefit from increases in global trade and certainly the benefits of e-commerce. And I think those two elements really provide this underlying forward momentum for the overall economy, suggesting that, you know, once you get past the fiscal cliff, we still have good economic growth of about 1.5% to 2% in 2013.
We don't have much more time, but for me to mention it, that oil prices as well, also a factor for FedEx, no doubt. John Sylvia is chief economist at Wells Fargo. Thanks, John, as always.
Thank you.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
So here's a quick roundup for you of the latest in these ever-shifting fiscal cliff talks. Negotiators for the president and House Speaker John Boehner are stuck somewhere between $400,000 and $1 million in terms of the income level above which taxes would rise. The temporary break in the payroll tax that many of us have enjoyed the last couple of years seems likely to disappear. And both sides seem to agree on letting capital gains and dividend taxes go up to at least 20%. So all of this will get us some quite modest distance toward addressing the U.S. budget deficit. On the revenue side, at least, some treasured tax breaks are coming in for close scrutiny. And one of the country's leading social conservatives is weighing in on the matter. Ralph Reed helped launch the Christian Coalition back in 1989. Today, he's chairman of the Faith and Freedom Coalition. Good to talk with you.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Good to be with you.
Whether it happens right now or into next year, at some point, it seems like a big deficit-cutting deal needs to be done. What are the priorities that you are asking lawmakers to keep in mind?
Well, we need to recognize that solving the fiscal mess in Washington shouldn't be done in a way that I think undermines the ability of middle-class families with children to provide for the care, nurture, and education of their children. That's why we've called for indexing the $1,000 per child tax credit to inflation and ultimately doubling it to $2,000. And we've also urged that the full tax deductibility of charitable contributions be preserved. And the reason for that is because there are 50 million people in America every day who are touched directly by a charity. And we believe that those charities can do a better job of meeting the needs of the poor and needy than the government.
As lawmakers look for cuts, everybody does have something that they want to protect. And last year, almost a third of Americans' charitable giving did go to religious organizations. You and the people that you represent, you do have a very clear interest in protecting that, do you not?
Well, I don't have a personal clear interest because I'm not trying to protect charitable organizations per se. I'm trying to make sure that the vital social welfare role that they conduct in society is not only continuing, but is strengthening. There have been studies done that have shown that if you limit or eliminate tax deductibility of charitable contributions, that you will lower charitable giving.
So the spending cuts and the revenues to find our way out of this mess have to come from somewhere. Are you proposing something in particular instead?
Well, you know, it's real easy to say that there's a lot of revenue there, but But the latest proposal from President Obama is to only raise the top rate on people making over $400,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, according to the CBO, that's only going to generate about $300 billion over 10 years. So we're talking about projected deficits of $10 trillion, and the revenue being offered by the president is $300 billion. So I think it's going to be a combination of higher revenue, but that's only going to get us so far, and then a long downward arc as a percentage of GDP in the size of the federal government.
Ralph Reed is chairman of the Faith and Freedom Coalition. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
The world's most polluting source of energy could soon become the world's most used. A report from the International Energy Agency today says coal could overtake oil within a decade. From our European desk, here's Stephen Beard.
The agency says that economic growth in China and India is driving demand for coal. By 2030, those two countries alone will account for two-thirds of global consumption. This explosive growth, says the agency, could jeopardize the battle to cut carbon emissions and pose other problems. Dieter Helm, author of The Carbon Crunch, says coal is the number one enemy of the environment.
It's not just that it produces a lot of carbon emissions. It produces a lot of other pollutants too. Methane leaks from the coal mines. It pollutes the water tables. It's pretty hard to think of anything worse than coal.
The IEA says the only hope of stemming coal use is by following the US example and turning to much cleaner natural gas. Coal demand will rise in every region except the US, where the shale revolution is replacing coal and cutting emissions faster than almost anywhere else. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
If you don't have kids, you might not know that there's such a thing as a pediatric dentist. The American Dental Association, though, says this is the fastest growing dental specialty by far. There's exploding demand, evidently, for visits to the dentist that are nothing like what you and I probably had as a kid. Here's Marketplace's Mark Garrison.
Did you have a good Thanksgiving?
Yeah.
Eat a lot of turkey?
New York dentist Dr. Jed Best is wrapping up with 7-year-old Owen Taylor. His attitude toward going to the dentist might surprise you.
It's cool. fun.
Yes, fun. It starts in the waiting room, which has two video game consoles and lots of toys for kids to romp around with. Owen's mother, Allison, has two children in Dr. Best's care.
Both of my kids love coming here. They look forward to it.
That's because everything is kid-friendly, including Dr. Best's gentle chairside manner. He mixes simplified dental advice and wisecracks, wearing scrubs decorated with cartoon characters.
We're trained to make things that are stressful, not necessarily stress-free, but at least less stressful. And children feel comfortable in that environment.
He says unlike some general dental practices, his thrives even through tough economic times. Parents may think twice about paying out of pocket for their own teeth, but few hesitate to give their kids the best. Growing parental awareness is increasing demand for child dentists. NYU's College of Dentistry is part of the supply. The waiting room is full of parents and young patients. Dental students learn to keep kids comfortable by playing games and reading Snuggle Puppy with them.
What does it say? Snuggle Puppy up.
Dr. Amir Morsi chairs the pediatric dentistry department. The field is attractive because it can be fun and lucrative, meaning a faster path to paying off student debt. There's also less hassle with insurance companies.
Most of the procedures we do don't entail a lot of complicated prior approval, sending in x-rays and extra documentation.
Yes, this is going to be your first one, and you're not going to give them a hard time.
Joy McClanahan has two daughters, aged 6 and 1, the youngest on her lap.
A regular dentist couldn't get me to open my mouth or do half of the things that they can actually convince the children to do.
Parents are also convinced, which is why dentistry for small kids is such a big and growing business. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Okay, before we wrap up here, if I say the words eagle baby to you today, do you instantly know what I'm talking about? Well, in case you don't, here's the deal. In this age of Photoshop and movie special effects, many of us pride ourselves on being savvy enough to spot a fake. So, if you haven't yet, go test your shrewd perception on the viral video du jour. Okay, so here's how it works. The amateur cameraman is following an eagle who's swooping over a park in Montreal, and suddenly the big golden eagle swoops down and catches up a baby which is playing a ways away in the grass. So, don't worry, everybody, no harm done. Ultimately, the baby seems to be too heavy. The eagle struggles to gain even a couple of feet and then leaves the baby on the ground. So this strains credulity, I know, but it does look pretty remarkable. At this moment, Surf in the Net, the official verdict on whether this is actually fake or not seems to be out. And finally, if maybe fake eagle attacks are not enough in the holiday spirit for you, here's an item on the state-of-the-art in gingerbread house technology. Johan von Kanau is an engineer in Sweden who recently came into possession of a laser engraver. And the result here is a meticulous laser-cut gingerbread replica of his summer home, which is as precise as any architectural model. But von Kanau did discover an unfortunate drawback to the technique. Laser-scorched gingerbread apparently tastes absolutely disgusting. Kind of like burned hair is the way he describes it. So kids, don't leave that laser-scorched gingerbread house out for Santa Claus, would you? That's it for today's Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.